investigation. In this last minute we have left, what kind of response have you gotten?
The response that we got from the Department of Justice is that they have too much oversight and they couldn't cover their fiduciary responsibility to the tribes. And one of our council members had stated to them that there's 257 police stations that, you know, they have a responsibility to. And there still was no investigation. It's very disrupting that, you know, they don't do their part and do their job that they're obligated to do. You know, but it doesn't surprise me, as we learned in this case. It's like, you know, we'd want multiple things being done, but it just doesn't happen for Indigenous people. You know, it's like asking them to free Leonard Peltier or you know, asking them to stop the pipeline immediately. These things just don't happen. They make it so difficult for Indigenous people, you know, to be functional and equal justice. And, you know, the
James Wright, we're going to have to leave it there as the show ends, but we're going to do part two, and we're going to post it online at democracynow.org. James Wright, uncle of Jacqueline Saliers. Stephanie Wood will link to your piece. And in these times, a major investigation, the police killings, no one's talking about it. That does it for our show. We'll be broadcasting from 80 Eastern Standard Time to 11:30 tonight, covering the last presidential debate, and a two-hour special tomorrow expanding the debate. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Friends of the Library used book sale Friday, October 21st through Monday, October 24th at the DoubleTree Exhibit Hall in Portland. Thousands of gently used books, media, pamphlets, and more will be available for purchase. Again, that's the Friends of the Library used book sale, Friday, October 21st through Monday, October 24th at the DoubleTree Exhibit Hall, 1000 Northeast Multnomah Street in Portland. More events can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Ralph Nader in Portland Rally to Get Big Money Out of Politics, taking place Saturday, October 22nd at 6 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Ralph Nader, along with local progressive leaders, will speak in support of the Get Big Money Out of Politics effort on the Multnomah County November ballot. There will also be a book signing and Q&A after the speech. Again, that's Ralph Nader Rally in Portland, Saturday, October 22nd at 6 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1121 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, accessories, and gifts with a focus on U.S.-made and certified fair trade natural fiber clothing since 1984. Gazelle is located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com.
This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland. My name's Paul Rowan. Be with you till 9 o'clock. We queued up the wrong song there. I wanted to play Which Side by Jackson Browne on his Standing in the Breach release. Maybe we'll have that as we go out. Anyway, here we are. And I wanted to talk about class. I read this article really excellent article in Mother Jones, the most recent Mother Jones, called No Country for White Men, How Donald Trump Took a Working Class Narrative of Unfairness and Twisted It to His Advantages, to His Advantage, by Arlie Russell Hochschild, Professor Emerita of Sociology at Berkeley, who's written, as I find, quite a number of interesting books and articles over the years. And I'm going to read a little bit of that article. And then, you know, as I was researching, I tried to get her on the show. She will be coming on a future show, she assured me. And I found a bunch of other things. I found some stuff on YouTube by Thomas Frank, the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, but most recently a book from this year called Listen, Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. And I'm going to play that clip in a little bit from a talk he did based on that. Then I come across this article from The Guardian 6 days ago called Dangerous Idiots, How the Liberal Media Elite Failed Working Class Americans, subtitled Trump Supporters Are Not the Caricatures Journalists Depict, a Native Kansan. Sarah Smarsh sets out to correct what newsrooms get wrong. 13th of October in The Guardian. And I got to say, it's just interesting that two of the people I've cited have some connection with Kansas. My mom was born in Kansas, and I guess that's my connection to the working class, because she was, after all, a poor Depression era farm family, and kind of married into the middle class in some ways. And that's what I grew up in, the very privileged white suburbs of Washington, D.C. and Maryland. Went to a pretty, one of those Washington suburban high schools. You know, that still had a little bit of lingering working class students and culture there until it was pretty much completely gentrified out over the next few decades. So you're not going to find much in Bethesda and Chevy Chase anymore. But at the time, there actually still was. Enough about me, but yeah, I grew up there. I went to a wealthy kind of elite Ivy League, minor Ivy League school, Wesleyan University in Connecticut, never really, you know, lived a working class life, but I sort of, in a way, dropped out, never really got on the career track, never, you know, I don't think I've ever made even $10,000 a year. I've also kind of had it lucky. I've also always been able to depend upon family money in times of need. So I've never really had to face real difficult economic circumstances like a lot of people, increasing number of people. But I've also kind of lived on the margins and on the edges, and certainly hung out with and befriended a lot of working class and more marginal people. So anyway, that's where I'm at. We can talk about that. But I'd like to get into this. You know, there's, you know, I've had Chris Hedges on, who has written many, many books and articles talking about the death of the liberal class, the betrayal of the working class by the liberal class. And the three authors that I cited all in some ways talk about that theme. But let's get to that first clip of a talk by Thomas Frank right now. No, I guess it disappeared from the screen. Anyway, we'll get to that. Maybe we'll find that again as Liam looks for that. It's a talk that he gave called Listen, Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People? Starts at 5:08, I think I told Liam earlier. And maybe we'll have that up in a second. And of course, as I said, Thomas Frank wrote What's the Matter with Kansas? And his new book, Listen, Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Here we go.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for my patience.
No, I guess not.
Entirely my fault. It's a very great pleasure.
Okay, just turn that off, Liam. We'll just, if we can find that, we can go to the other clip from Arlie Hochschild. Maybe you can cue that up. You got that?
Actually, I'm in the middle of studying another new strange civil war in the United States. You know that we, in the mid-19th century, had a massive civil war where the South tried to secede from the North. The issues were, of course, different, but I think we are in the midst now in the United States of an unprecedented kind of rupture of a new sort.
That's the track you want?
Not only in the last 30 years has there been a growth of our right wing. Right and left mean different things,
You got to press either the space
bar. What I'm really referring to is a rupture between a whole sort of mainstream political body that may disagree about what the government should do, but think there should be a government, and an increasing right-wing group that feels that actually we don't need a government, just a military and a few police, but really 85 to 90% of it, get rid of it and we'll be fine. And they call themselves the Tea Party. So it's created a new polarization. Not only do left and right now listen to different television stations, CNN or NBC on one side and Fox News on the other, there is a new book out, The Big Sort, that tells about how when people move, it's not just to better jobs and cheaper houses and nicer weather, but to politically compatible communities. So we're living differently, we're enjoying different sources of news, we're more separate. Thirdly, there's a hardening of positions, and political belief is a little more like religious belief. A study that was done 30 years ago asked people if Democrats and Republicans, if a child of yours was going to marry a member of the other party, would it disturb you? Well, 3% were disturbed on the Democrat side, 5% on the Republican side. It wasn't a big deal. But recently, that same question was asked, and it was found that a third of Democrats would be disturbed, and over half of Republicans would be disturbed. So there's a kind of separate into poles, but there's a hardening of positions.
I'll talk some more.
Yeah, there are times when it may look from here, and it looks to us there, like we're in the middle of a comic opera of the top 12 Republican candidates for the U.S. president. Three absolutely reject the idea of evolution, and no one of the 12 unambivalently embraces it. Jeb Bush has said no, he believes in the principle of Darwin and evolution, but he doesn't believe that children in schools should learn about it. So if we go to global warming or climate change, we find that of the 12 top Republican candidates, 6 straight out deny the role of human conduct in exacerbating or creating global warming. 5 say the science is unclear, and only one of the 12 says, yes, it's real and we should take measures. And then we come to Donald Trump. Who thinks that one of the major issues in this race for the presidency is whether or not his hair is real? Some claim it's unreal, toupee, others that it's real. And he's resolved this vital matter by telling a woman to come on stage and pull his hair to see if it's real.
All right. I hadn't fully listened to that earlier, sorry. But that was, again, Arlie Hochschild, the author of the new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. And we're talking about culture wars. We're talking about the sort of extreme polarization that's happening. But I really wanted to talk about this article that she wrote based on her new book called No Country for White Men, in which she talks about, you know, it's the same thing that Sarah Smarsh says in her article, Dangerous Idiots, How the Liberal Media Elite Failed Working Class Americans, that it's the myth of these Donald Trump supporters as being, you know, what some people disparagingly think of as, quote, white trash, that people think of them as ignorant, unwashed people, that they're rabid racists and homophobes. And, you know, obviously there's truth in that because their homophobia and racism are rampant throughout our society, unfortunately. But it's actually more that these people are more middle class, but feel that they can slip into the lower class. That seems to be the more dominant Trump supporters. So anyway, she talks about in this book the deep story of these people. She says, I'm just going to read this paragraph. She's talking to this woman, Sharon. She spent a bunch of time, like 5 years, going to Louisiana, that for her like represented sort of the epitome. This is before actually that Trump ran for president, and to work on this book about this divide that she's talking about in that clip that we had. And she met this woman, Sharon, who I think worked in real estate. Anyway, as we pulled up to her home, Sharon reflected on various theories her mother had. "Have you heard of the Illuminati, the New World Order?" Sharon asked, so as to prepare me. "I'm Tea Party," Sharon said, "but I don't go along with a lot that my mom does." Whether they clung to such dark notions or laughed them off, Tea Party enthusiasts lived in a roaring rumor sphere that offered answers to deep, abiding anxieties. Why did President Obama take off his wristwatch during Ramadan? Why did Walmart run out of ammunition on the third Tuesday in March? Did you know drones can detect how much money you have? Many described these as suspicions other people held. Many seemed to float in a zone of half-belief. The most widespread of these suspicions, of course, shared by 66% of Trump supporters, is that Obama is Muslim. What the people I interviewed were drawn to was not necessarily the particulars of these theories. It was the deep story underlying them, an account of life as it feels to them. Some such account underlies all beliefs, right or left, I think. The deep story of the right goes like this. You're patiently standing in the middle of a long line stretching toward the horizon, where the American dream awaits. But as you wait, you see people cutting in line ahead of you. Many of these line cutters are black, beneficiaries of affirmative action or welfare. Some are career-driven women pushing into the jobs they never had before. Then you see immigrants, Mexicans, Somalis, the Syrian refugees yet to come. As you wait in this unmoving line, you're being asked to feel sorry for them all. You have a good heart, but who is deciding who you should feel compassion for? Then you see President Barack Hussein Obama waving the line cutters forward. He's on their side. In fact, isn't he a line cutter too? How did this fatherless black guy pay for Harvard? As you wait your turn, Obama is using the money in your pocket to help the line cutters. He and his liberal backers have removed the shame from taking. The government has become an instrument for redistributing your money to the undeserving. It's not your government anymore. It's theirs. And that's in italics, this deep story that she sort of distilled from these conversations, you know, her own research over the years and these conversations with these many people in Louisiana. And then she continues, "I checked this distillation with those I interviewed to see if this version of the deep story rang true. Some altered it a bit." Quote, I mean, parentheses, "the line waiters form a new line," end parentheses, "or emphasize a particular point. Those in back are paying for the line cutters." But all of them agreed it was their story. One man said, "I like your, I live your analogy." Another said, "You read my mind." The deep story reflects pain. You've done everything right, and you're still slipping back. It focuses blame on an ill-intentioned government, and it points to rescue, the Tea Party for some and Donald Trump for others. But what had happened to make the deep story ring true? Most of the people I interviewed were middle class, and nationally, more than half of all Tea Party supporters earn at least $50,000, while almost a third earn more than $75,000 a year. Many, however, had been poor as children and felt their rise to have been an uncertain one. As one wife of a well-to-do contractor told me, gesturing around the buck heads hanging above the large stone fireplace in the spacious living room of her Lake Charles home, "We have our American dream, but we could lose it all tomorrow." Being middle class didn't mean you felt secure, because that class was thinning out as a tiny elite shot up to great wealth and more people fell into a life of broken teeth, unpaid rent, and shame. Anyway, that's from this article in the new Mother Jones called No Country for White Men, How Donald Trump Took a Working Class Narrative of Unfairness and Twisted It to His Advantage. And in that clip that I was going to play, and we may still play, by Thomas Frank, he calls it a fake populism. He says, the Huey Long without the compassion. And again, in this Guardian article, Sarah Smarsh sort of talks about some of the same issues, dangerous idiots, how the liberal media elite failed working class Americans. And she too says that Trump voters are actually middle class. She says hard numbers complicate, if not roundly dismiss, the oft regurgitated theory that income or education levels predict Trump support, or that working class whites support him disproportionately. Last month, results of 87,000 interviews conducted by Gallup showed that those who liked Trump were under no more economic distress or immigration-related anxiety than those who opposed him. So, yes, there's these deep, deep issues going back all the way, I would say, to the founding of this country and, you know, the anxiety of people over the marauding savages on the frontier. The anxiety of poor whites at the prospect of many freed slaves flooding into the market, and the cynical manipulation of that by people in power to keep the, you know, in the to come out of slavery and basically continue slavery under other forms, the brutal manipulation of new immigrant classes to keep other people down. And it's an old story, and we're seeing the fruits of it now in this as the economic miracle machine of America sputters, and possibly capitalism will never be able to potentially regain its miraculous, seemingly miraculous powers in the mid-20th century. We're in new realities. And the culture wars that have been going on for decades are getting worse. And you have this, you know, vast kind of group of fair amount of working class and a large amount of the shrinking middle class that are getting more desperate. And of course, you know, that's what led to the rise of fascism in the 20s and 30s, and people are talking about it as a possibility here. Anyway, I'll stop talking. I'd like to talk to you about this. If you've been thinking about these issues I'm bringing forward, 503-231-8187. Otherwise, I'll just read some more of these articles and play some more of these clips. But something I've been thinking a lot about, and I'm sure it's on a lot of other people's minds as well. 503-231-8187. You know, this term that I sort of coined, and I haven't seen anyone else use it. I call us Americaners, A-M-E-R-I-K-A-N-E-R-S, to parallel the Afrikaners in South Africa. Basically, you know, a direct parallel, the settler colonials who, you know, are now, even though in South Africa, the indigenous population vastly outnumbered the settler population, and so had to be there had to be an institution of this very brutal segregated society and politics and economics. And here the native peoples were the victims of a genocide and disease, and so it's somewhat different. But here we have the people who are forcibly removed, African peoples forcibly removed from their homelands, and ended up forming actually a larger population than the Native Americans here. And so there had to be devised a system very similar to what was devised in South Africa to keep them in check. So it looks like we may have our first caller, potentially. Number is 503-231-8187. Go ahead, Dave. You're on the air. Hello?
James.
James, go ahead.
I am a classical liberal / right-winger. And what's happening is Americans are... it is the resurgence of classical liberalism.
What's classical liberalism?
Classical liberalism, yes. In other words, the resurgence of Jeffersonian democracy.
And what is that again? What is that?
Jeffersonian democracy?
Yeah.
That's federalism.
And what's that?
Our federal system of government was created with the idea that the federal government was limited to a list of enumerated powers listed in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Its primary purpose of the federal government was to focus on external objects. In other words, focus on war, peace negotiations, treaties, and such. Each individual state is sovereign. In other words, Virginia is akin to England, Massachusetts is akin to France, and so on and so forth. And these are a coalition of states, and that's what this is all about. We want to restore sovereignty and self-determination to the people. And all this...
Which people? How about the treaties with the indigenous nations? I thought that those are the supreme laws under the Constitution.
We should. Actually, we should. In fact, those cowboys in southern Oregon, they wanted to do that. And we all would like to see Native Americans have their own nation.
Their own nation? But that might mean giving up vast tracts of land that you seem to claim as sovereign by the states.
Thomas Jefferson believed and advocated that Native Americans be brought into the Union as states. Our federal system was an idea that they got from the Iroquois. It is a Native American system.
Right. Well, it seems to be more honored in the breach than in the observance. I mean, Jefferson advocated the removal of them across the Stony Mountains.
Well, there was a problem with the Brits hired Native Americans to go after the colonists, and that was part of the reason. They were mercenaries for the British, which is they were kind of like the Hessians.
Well, so, I mean, the colonists were encroaching upon native lands. Part of the conflict that led to the American Revolution was the colonist displeasure with the English Royal Proclamation of 1763, which limited the colonists going across the Appalachian Mountains. And so the colonists were very displeased with that. They wanted to get those lands for themselves, and that was against the existing agreements.
What you have to understand is that imperialists have had their fingers, have their hands in our government from the very foundation. They have ignored the Constitution from the beginning. The imperialists purchased the Supreme Court from the very beginning. A lot of this stuff, the reason they're able to do that is because through propaganda and the newspapers, which the media they own throughout the nation, they're able to keep us divided and at odds with one another. We need to come together. This is not no longer a left-right thing. If this thing, this TPP thing, and the Native Americans that are protesting up there in North Dakota and stuff, I would stand with those people in a heartbeat. And we should all be able to, have self-determination at the local level. In other words, this is another thing too. Those of you on the left, you say that you advocate for multiculturalism, and you do not, because you have given us a kingdom. You have enabled imperialists to establish a kingdom here in America, and what we are seeing is a kingdom and all that goes with it, the tyranny that goes with a kingdom.
Well, actually, if you want to hold on a second. We've got someone else on the line that, if it's this person I'm thinking of, maybe she might have some interesting, just stay on the line. Jacqueline, are you there? Let's bring her up too. Go ahead.
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Hi, yes, I am.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I just was calling in to say hello, and I caught a bit of the gentleman's responses. And actually, I've been writing, comparing. I covered the. I'm Native American. I'm Dakota and Dene, and I covered the Malheur refuge takeover, and I've written about comparing the Bundy's claims to sovereignty to that of my own indigenous nations. And I think that when the states unified, and they were actually not inspired by King, but they were inspired by the Iroquois Confederacy, which during the decades before the colonists rose up, the Ta-Idaho, who was the leader of the Iroquois Confederacy, toured the colonies and urged them to unite as the Iroquois Confederacy had united. And that symbol of the arrows that are held by the eagle on our currency and our seal is a symbol that he brought. He would take a bunch of arrows and then show how they could, a single arrow could be broken, but then united they could not be broken. So this is a traditional indigenous idea of governance.
But do you think, I mean, James, this is a really complicated argument. I'm not sure we'll be able to carry it off here, but James was bringing up this sort of certain perspective that says that we've gone away from the original ideas. And so
the states are not sovereign. The indigenous nations are sovereign. Under international law, the states gave up their sovereignty to the federal government when they joined, and that's only the 13 original colonies that ever had pre-existing sovereignty. But the states that were created by the U.S. government have never possessed sovereignty on the international scale. But indigenous nations do, because we pre-exist the creation of the United States. And
well,
also
we don't.
Let me finish. And so when they, when the U.S. government signed treaties with indigenous nations, they recognize their sovereignty, because the Senate does not ratify treaties with anyone but sovereign nations. So this is international law, And under international law, nations cannot treaty away their sovereignty, and by signing a treaty does not extinguish their existence. So Native nations are sovereign and exist as sovereign nations under international law, and actually exist politically, and this is stated in the Constitution, have a higher political status in states. That's why they only have a federal relationship, because the sovereignty exists only with the federal government in the United States situation, not with the states.
Okay, let's hold off a second. This is not the conversation that I intended to have, but I think this is the kind of conversation that actually needs to happen. We may not be able to have it really in the full here, but go ahead, James, respond.
Well, she's talking about international law. I know nothing of international law. It's enough for me to. I've spent the last few years just studying the Constitution, and I've gone back to the 1100 Charters of Liberty, the Magna Carta, the Grand Remonstrance, and I've been working the history of our Constitution also goes back to the Anglo-Saxons. They were communities. Small communities living in harmony, and these kings kept attacking them, and they kept forcing kings on them, and so the Anglo-Saxons.
This is not the situation here.
I just wanted to point out that this nation, that the 13 colonies got together and they formed 13 independent.
Well, they have self-rule, but they do not have sovereignty. Okay, hold on.
You guys both just cool down there for a second. Yeah. No, let me try to say how I think we can proceed with this conversation, because I think this is an important one. So, James, I think the problem is I think you're on the right track, and I share a lot what you're saying in terms of trying to understand our origins as as settlers, basically as people who are descendants of people who came to this land. The problem is you're trying to basically impose something on a completely different situation. They didn't. The people who came here weren't able, either they left their original place, England, or in my case, Italy, or whatever. And so they sort of left, they stopped fighting to work out those contradictions and conflicts that the Magna Carta and all those things were trying to do. And they basically became part of a colonial force. And so that creates a really different situation that I think you really have to come to grips with that. So, Jacqueline, go ahead and talk about that maybe.
I think the colonial aspect is really important, because if you look at what's happening in North Dakota, and I just returned from Standing Rock, and my family are Dakota. My grandmother's family used to live in Wakpala on Standing Rock. And you can quite clearly see that the state of North Dakota is a colonial enterprise. The goal of states, and they were created by the federal government, that they would basically, and including the colonies, which were created as corporations, signed with the King of England, these were money making enterprises, corporate enterprises. And when people came here as colonists, whether they came here as indentured servants or the younger sons of noblemen who wanted to have plantations, these were primarily financial money making enterprises, and the way they view the land was one of complete exploitation of the land. And you can see that going on in North Dakota right now, where you have the colonial state of North Dakota basically using full-on military force against prayerful, peaceful, Native Americans and their allies. And when I woke up on Saturday morning, they were doing a call, they were praying with the pipes, and they were playing John Trudell over the speaker system, and they were saying, "We are the people of the earth. Who are you?" And that's the real question, is who are Europeans? Who are they really? He's pointing to a history of, feudalism, of top-down government. When they came to this land, they were inspired by the indigenous people who had democratic institutions of government. That's why, democracy was inspired by the Iroquois Confederacy. The ideals we have as modern are primarily indigenous to this land. Okay. They've spread around the world.
Okay, we have another caller waiting, but I just want to give James another chance to respond if you've taken in what's been said. Go ahead, James.
The states came together and created the federal government. The federal government is subservient to the states. It is an employee of the states. It was never intended to be the master.
Yeah, I think it was.
How come you fascists?
Okay. James. It seemed like that might have been promising, but anyway, maybe if we were all in the same room and we had a couple hours to calmly talk this out, we might be able to tease out some of these things. But unfortunately, the limitations of this medium and this hour-long show are such as they are. So, Jacqueline, stay where. Maybe we'll go to another caller. I think this is kind of interesting to have people on at the same time. Is Lee still with us? Lee, are you there?
I'm here.
Go ahead. What's your contribution to this interesting conversation?
I thought that you were talking about economic class and what was happening to the population of this country vis-a-vis their economic status.
That was the beginning, and then it sort of morphed into another conversation. What's your take on that?
Well, on which thing? The initial?
Yeah, well, I think it's all tied together.
I recently read a book by Robert Gordon entitled "The Rise and Fall of American Growth," and it was mind-boggling because there were some huge technological changes that allowed people to live better lives. And fundamentally, the growth that this country and other countries had because of those technological changes, greatly increased our standard of living. But somewhere many years ago, many decades ago, I came to realize that as population of the world grew with only limited resources of the earth, that there was going to be less available for individuals to consume proportionally. And yet in our current society, in our current culture, materialism is the way we value success. So, there's less resources to convert into materials to be available for people. And I don't think American society has come to grips with that. They're still being manipulated by propaganda that says, buy, this is the culture that you ought to have.
Oh, yeah, it's the as I started out by talking about the idea of the American dream, which was, basically this limitless abundance of this, this vast virgin continent that unpopulated by real human beings, aka Europeans, and therefore open to the kind of ruthless exploitation that Jacqueline was talking about. And it's that myth that that sustained and was able to sort of override brutally all the its own contradictions, and now all those contradictions are just spilling out all over the place, and we're having to deal with the results. Jacqueline, do you have a response to that?
Yeah, I mean, this was not an unpopulated, this was already, Native Americans have domesticated most of the crops grown around the world. 70% were originally domesticated here in the Western Hemisphere. There was amazing cultural diversity. I think you've had Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz on your show in her book, Indigenous History of the United States, Indigenous People's History of the United States. She describes how cultivated the land was when the colonists came. They could, it was like already gardens. Everything was already laid out. There were roads. They could drive through the forest, it was already all here already. The idea that this was pristine wilderness only happened later after a lot of colonists didn't take care of things. And then the woods got overgrown and everything. But there was, it was all, I mean, she describes in her book how the Iroquois Confederacy that I mentioned earlier, New York State, the reason why Buffalo is named Buffalo, and I didn't know this, my in-laws are Iroquois, and my mother-in-law is from Buffalo, but the reason is that the Iroquois actually created a kind of a bowling alley all the way through the woods there, and to lead buffalo from the Great Plains all the way into Iroquois territory so they could hunt them.
So the idea, I guess, we're, you know, you're putting out, and when I share, is that, you know, there is some sort of maybe a fundamental problem with colonial culture that...
Well, it's a story they told themselves, that this is all, like, they created all this. This right. wasn't here before they got here. And, you know, when you look at, when I drive through states, when you look at the difference between reservations and, like, in North Dakota, the communities there, the poverty there versus, and then the kind of smugness of the white community, you have to ask yourself, where does the wealth of the United States come from?
They stole it from the Native Americans when they exploited the resources that were here.
Exactly.
And they exploited them in such a way that it's, you know, they didn't do it in a renewable, sane manner. They just plain, you know, plundered. And that's
exactly.
where the wealth of this country
exactly, and you know, I think
and,
that
when, and the, and of course have, the so-called free labor of African Americans, that's the other twin pillar that we must never forget.
I just wanted to finish my point really fast.
Yeah, go ahead.
I got interrupted but yeah, I mean, when you look at towns like in North Dakota and South Dakota, and you see how pristine and well kept they are, and then you look at the neighboring Native communities, and when you're talking about, you know, Standing Rock, and you know, Standing Rock is one of the, you're talking about land where all these reservations are islands of larger land. So the Great Sioux Nation once went from almost the Great Lakes all the way to Montana. And so what we have left are these islands left of land. And so everything in between is stolen land, stolen resources, and is used to prop up the economies and of these different communities. And so this is this is why Native people are poor, you know, Native nations are poor. And it's very frustrating when Native people speak up and then to have the white community go, well, you know, stop taking handouts. When everything that North Dakota and South Dakota has, the money they spend is entirely taken from Native communities.
Well, you know,
that one large handout.
So that ties into the original, where I started off with this conversation, taking handouts was this sort of myth of, like, you know, again, that there's all these people who are taking from the federal government, you know, whether it's welfare queens or people on food stamps or supposedly immigrants who actually contribute way more, you know, in taxes than they're giving any credit for. So the idea of, you know, it's this embattled minority sense, and now they really are becoming a minority. The what I call the Americaners, us Americaners, I include myself, this sort of to parallel with the Afrikaners in South Africa. There's sort of this embattled sense now that sort of was masked again by the brazenness of the assault, you know, and the seemingly complete takeover of the of the continent. And so now we're kind of seeing this, the cracks in that, and the psychology, which is being pointed at again in this article.
Well, you know, when you look at the level of that in North Dakota, that the state of North Dakota is arming themselves, the jailing of journalists. You know, they're still trying to jail Amy Goodman for her coverage of the dog attacks on Native protesters, and none of this is making the news. I mean, you know, I was really disappointed when President Obama did not address the dog attacks and the dog bites of Native children in a community that he visited and swore to protect those children. You know, it definitely makes very clear that this is not our country. The things that matter to us do not make the national news when we have our children bitten by dogs by, you know, private security forces employed by energy companies. Nobody, the president does not comment on it. There's no mention of it. Native people are not a part of this country. Do you know what I mean? It's just very clear, and that our citizenship is primarily with our own nations, I think that what we see when we see in North Dakota, we see the armed occupation. It's clear what states are. I think that Americans should have an honest discussion about what is the state. The state, what made a state? How did it go from being a territory to a state? It's all about the absorption of land. And the U.S. the revolution, the colonists was you're right. It's all about trying to take the Ohio Valley, which Tecumseh fought against. The state of Ohio is the creation of the taking of land. There are no Indians left there. And here we have the Cleveland Indians proudly wearing Chief Wahoo while they're trying to get to the World Series.
This is deep stuff, and we're going to keep talking about that because, of course, we are speaking with Jacqueline Keeler, who's my new once-a-month co-host, who just got back from North Dakota, as she said. And we'll have you on, obviously, certainly in 3 weeks on our next show, and hopefully we'll have you on to talk more fully about your trip even before that. But we do have other callers, so thank you so much for calling, Jacqueline. And James, you still with us?
Oh, I'm Lee, and I'm still here.
Oh, okay, Lee, that's right. I'm sorry. James was the one who was calling us fascists, and we had to leave. But let's hold on a second. I don't know if Renee is still on, who's been waiting patiently. Are you there, Renee? Oh, I guess not. Sorry about that, Renee. I don't know. This is something a little different. I kind of like the idea of having multiple callers at the same time.
Well, it's kind of hard to,
Did you take him off? That was our engineer's fault. Sorry, Lee. Anyway, the number to call is 503-231-8187. This is kind of a free-form conversation, but what Jacqueline was bringing up is something that we're going to get deeper into as we go along, as she has a regular presence here. Once a month or more, perhaps. Talking about these issues, one thing that I've talked about in the past, having to do with this as well, is the establishment of James, our first caller, was talking about the Constitution, and the states have the sovereign power and everything, but if you hear people like Thomas Lindsay of the Community Rights Movement. It's really the Commerce Clause, which is kind of the engine, the main pillar of the Constitution in a way, which basically created, the first free trade zone. These people who are all against the TPP and all, really it's modeled upon the free trade zone that was the original 13 states that created a free trade zone amongst themselves with the enshrined in the Commerce Clause and interstate commerce, which is basically what allows things like the Dakota Access Pipeline to be built, and the thousands of miles of pipelines and interstate highways, the reign of terror of the automobile that is the destroying our climate. But I could go on and on. So Renee apparently is back. Go ahead, Renee.
Hi. Yes. Thank you for taking my call, and I wanted to say I like your Americana statement. That term is really good, and I'm calling because of the states' rights that James was talking about. I'm a woman of color, and I've lived all over the U.S., every region in the U.S., I've lived there, and whenever I've heard this term, states' rights, is also tied to the belief in having state militias and all of that stuff, and this, these folks that were at Malheur, it's all wrapped into that stuff. But whenever I hear the term states' rights, it's always from a white male perspective. It's always a white male saying it. Maybe occasionally there's a white woman, but it's always this white perspective because they think state rights means, okay, it's going to go my way. It's going to be the way I want it. And I would like to invite this, James and people who think like him, okay, what if you lived in a state and the state's rights was that every white male had to take subservient jobs or work for free or, just be a second-class citizen, and the state's rights, the state's belief were that people of color and women, especially women of color, were essentially on the top. Making all the rules, making the policies, and skewing things in their favor. So when I hear the word states' rights, I just, I just get my back up. And I'm not going to speak for everyone, every person of color, but I think a lot of us feel that way.
Well, that's interesting that, because I think that brings it around again to the where I started with this conversation, which is this deep story that Arlie, Professor Arlie Hochschild was talking about in this article in the in Mother Jones, which is basically that the people do feel fear that they're slipping into something like that. There's this kind of, maybe it's not a real conscious fear, but that's what's sort of driving the Trumpism and the Tea Partyism, is this fear that people will lose exactly those privileges that you're talking about.
Yes, and you know, people are losing ground economically, but it has nothing to do with immigrants or people taking their jobs. They need to look up. They need to look at the corporations and the people that started this mess years ago, decades ago, started farming out our jobs, outsourcing jobs, becoming corporations, becoming people, you know, and things like that. That's where they need to look.
And some of them, and you know, and it's a strange mix, because you know, James, who the first caller, was talking about the TPP and stuff. So there is a glimmer of awareness of that, but it doesn't seem to gel or really solidify into a real crystal awareness.
True. Yeah, there is that wasn't kind of an oddball mix. Yes, yes. But and that Mother Jones article sounded really good. I wrote that down. I'm going to check that out today.
Well, good, because if I left people with anything, it was actually to read that article. And
right.
So thank you for calling in. That's great.
Thank you.
And looks like we got Jane up perhaps next. Hello?
Hello?
Go ahead. You're on the air.
I just wanted to say that I don't usually listen to your show, so I don't know you. I like the last caller. I would never vote for Donald Trump. But America is very complicated, very big country. My family's from North Carolina, and my family lived on the Underground Railroad. I'm Native American, I'm African American, and I am white. And I just want to say that it is a very complicated country. We could, you know, go on for hours. The French and the Spanish colonized America as well. California was tried to be colonized by the Spanish. I do think that there are many complicated issues and many sides to this story. And I like what the last caller said, but I do think it gets much more complicated, especially with so many half-breed Native Americans. You might have a white grandfather taking care of a Native American girl who's, I know someone who literally, her dad stole her reservation check and her identity to sell for drugs. He is Native American. The white grandparents take care of her because the daughter died of an enlarged heart. It gets complicated. I just really wish people would be careful. Again, I would never vote for Trump. I don't know why I'm saying that twice, but I do think that with global capitalism and global players and the American dream incorporating people of color, such as Japanese people, you know, Japanese people are global capitalists. They played a part in 9/11. They died in 9/11. They deforest the rainforest in Brazil.
You're making
very these, complicated.
Sure, I mean I don't know. You're making these statements about Japanese people, but I mean it's you're talking about, I think, more Japanese corporations, perhaps, and I don't know the connection to 9/11. That seems odd, but it is very complicated.
Japanese bankers were at the top floors of 9/11. It's a very big deal in Japan. I've lived in Japan,
okay.
And I just want to say that, you know, there are people, for example, who are Okinawan who don't like the Japanese because they committed genocide against Okinawans. But we don't talk about racism in Japan because Japanese people don't like Koreans or the Chinese.
Well,
and so it gets very complicated. Racism is very complicated because America incorporates the American dream for all people. So, for example, after World War II, Okane mochi ninaru, you know, I want to go to America and become rich. So people of color came here to become rich too. And yet, you know, Japanese people experience tremendous racism from white people. Like,
okay.
It becomes complicated.
No, you're right. You're right. And we're getting, you're taking into even more complicated realms. And unfortunately, we only have a minute left. And that's the nature of this program, especially if people get in at the end. But you brought up so many different things, and there's really no way we can incorporate them all. But I really thank you for calling, because it is incredibly complex. The only thing I would say is, how do we, the complexity it can be made more simple, perhaps, if we understand some of the basic political economic dynamics. But we're going to have to leave it there, and we're not going to be able to get to Camilo. Sorry about that. Thank you, Jane. Thank all of you who called. This has been an interesting program. We're talking about this, a number of books and articles, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. That's by Professor Arlie Hochschild, and she has an article in Mother Jones. I'd also recommend this article, Dangerous Idiots, How the Liberal Media Elite Failed Working Class Americans, in The Guardian by Sarah Smarsh, and Thomas Frank's work. Okay, with that, we're going to have to leave it right there. This has been Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Rowland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Affording the Portland We Want, October 20th, 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Walt McRee, chair of the Public Banking Institute, will discuss how a public bank of Portland could free up financial resources to build the Portland we want with the money we already have. How can we retain control of our tax dollars to invest at home instead of sending it off to Wall Street? Again, that's Affording the Portland We Want, October 20th at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information about the event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Eco Film Festival, Thursday through Sunday, October 20th through 23rd, at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. The Portland Eco Film Festival is the premier environmental film festival in the United States Pacific Northwest, showing the very best films about nature, the environment, outdoor pursuits, and eco-conscious living. Films that will be shown include Seed, The Untold Story, Silent Running, Saving Jamaica Bay, and many more. Again, that's the Portland Eco Film Festival, Thursday through Sunday, October 20th through 23rd at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast San